Hello and welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. You're listening to the podcast for people who want to learn about the government market from the contracting officer's perspective. If you are a contracting officer, we hope to give you a little more insight into industry's perspective. In today's episode, Kevin and I talk about Section L and Section M. We try to explain what they are and why they're important. This actually turned out to be a two-parter as the conversation got a little bit long. So today is part one, where we talk about what they are. In part two, we get a little bit deeper into why Section L and Section M are important to both government and to industry. This week's episode is sponsored by the Skyway Connection. If you need help with the government market from a team of contracting officers, visit Skyway Connection at skywayacquisition.com/connect. All right, let's get started. Hey, Kevin. Today we're here to talk about Section L and M. We're going to cover what they are, when they apply, or when you run into them in the acquisition. And most importantly, we're going to talk about why they're important to the acquisition team and why they're important to the offerors.
So this is a baseline discussion of what are sections L and M. So for those of you who are familiar with the Uniform Contract Format, you can go look it up in FAR 15204. But when you're looking at competitive source selection type contracts that you're going to have an actual RFP for, there are 13 parts and 13 parts of the RFP. Two of those parts, the important ones we're going to talk about today, are sections L, which is instructions to offerors. That's just what it sounds like. These are the instructions. This is what you're going to write in your proposal. Or if you're the contracting officer, this is what you're going to get, the formats, etc. And then there's Section M. That's the evaluation criteria. Is how is that stuff that you sent me in accordance with Section L going to be judged? So these are used for contracts by negotiation. And that's kind of what they are. They really are the last two pieces of the 13 sections of an RFP. And this is, here are the instructions. This is what you send me. And then this is how I'm going to evaluate you. Okay?
If you're not the contracts person in the industry, L and M are the keys. That's what you're interested in, because that tells you everything you need to know about the source selection. The rest of the RFP is the clauses and other things that the contracts people generally get into. But the rest of the proposal team generally keys in on L and M only.
Correct, and we'll get into the why that is in a few minutes. So when do these apply? And like I said, it's contracts by negotiation. This is right out of FAR Part 15. So if you're buying through a GSA schedule, doesn't apply. If you're buying on micro purchase, doesn't apply. But for lots and lots of, particularly for those people in the RFP zone, these apply. Okay, they also apply in specific areas such as FAR Part 12. They use different clauses. There's a 52.212-1. For those of you following along in the FAR, that clause effectively is your instructions offers, because a commercial. And the commercial procedures under FAR Part 12, it's a little bit different. The order is a little bit different. But the basic idea is that clause, 52.212-1, which is essentially your instructions offer. Instead of calling it Section L, they use that clause. Likewise, the mirror image in FAR Part 12 under commercial procedures is 52.212-2, which is your evaluation criteria. Just, we could get into a debate on why they changed the names on them. But just so you know, if it's a FAR Part 12 requirement, you're going to hear those two clauses, 212-1, 212-2, instead of Section L and M.
But the great, same thing.
You're given, they're going to tell you what to say, and then what to propose, and then how they're going to judge you on it. Now, something to keep in mind here, it doesn't apply to every type of contract. Very few things on the podcast in general apply everywhere. That's why you hear us a lot of times say things like generally, or most of the time, and very few times we'll say every, and we actually kind of backtrack and make sure that
right, because it's rarely every, not a lot of definitives in the contract world.
So here's an example of that, is that there's actually a section in FAR Part 15 that says when it doesn't apply. And for example, it's things like a letter contract, or what's known as an undefinitized contract action. And that's something that you're doing in a hurry. A letter contract is, okay, we need this in a hurry, we need this under a certain set of circumstances. You get a special approval for it, and you write a letter to an offeror and say, I need you to do this right now. So think like, you know, after 9/11, a lot of letter contracts got done. Okay, yeah, Section L and M is a different issue at that point.
Yeah, it's more of a sole source thing rather than a competitive thing. It's here, go get started, and we'll define all the terms and conditions explicitly later. But we need you to start right now. But you wouldn't do that if there was actually a competition going on.
And by the way, undefinitized contract action is actually out of Part 17. So, well, that'll be a different cast. Most of the stuff in any kind of, whenever you see an RFI, RFP, like you go back to the podcast number 8 we just did about draft RFPs and whatnot. Section L&M is one of the places you want to make sure you understand. You absolutely understand what's going on.
Right.
So understand this is when it applies.
All right. So Section L, Section M. What is Section L and what is Section M?
So Section L is your instructions. What are you going to be doing, right? So the specific language is guide to offers in preparing proposal. If you're a contracting officer sending out Section L, the offerors need to understand what exactly do you want me to send you. So things like the administrative features of how many volumes are there. Is there a management section? How many pages can it be? How many past performance references can I use? All kinds of different basic concepts. I mean, here's a fun one. Are you going to use certified or other than certified cost or pricing data? And there's a whole other discussion on that. But basically what they're asking is how much cost data has to go into this? Is there going to be a cost volume? All of that stuff. How much content am I going to be generating? What format does it have to be in? And this is where you're going to see stuff like 12-point font versus, you know, how many pages, how many graphics can you have? Do graphics count in the overall pages? Does the cover page count? Does the executive summary count? All those instructions.
It even gets down to what kind of binders to put it in, what kind of labels to put on the binders, and sometimes what how to put the binders in the boxes and how to put labels on the boxes when you deliver. I mean, Section L can really, really get down into administrivia that I've never really understood why all that matters so much, what exactly is on the label. But that's where it is.
And here's another one. So you're going to learn in there, are they going to take electronic proposals? Or are they going to need product samples? When are those product samples going to be due? Are they going to be due 2 weeks before the written portion? Or are they going to allow you to send electronic only? Are they going to expect paper only? So now you're thinking about, well, if I have 30 days to submit this proposal, but it's, I don't know, pick a number, 100-page proposal, and you need to have 10 copies of it, and it has to be delivered in paper, that means you better be done writing on like day 27 because you got to overnight that giant pile of stuff and it's got to get there on time.
Not to mention print and stack and count and all the other things involved.
Right. Find a staple gun that's big enough to staple 100 pieces of paper together. You know, all so all of this stuff is going to be in Section L. This is the instructions to what does the government expect to see. And just for fun, because we like to give you Farsight to go look at, it's 15204-5B is really the nuts. B as in Bravo.
So the Section L instructions, they're guidance, but they're also compliance. You have to follow every single thing that it says. If it says 12-point font, single spaced, half inch margins, there's a chance that some enterprising government contracting officer could get out a ruler and measure that if you're trying to game the system. And then there's a reason why that it's compliance, even though it can be very annoying and it can be difficult to follow the instructions to a T. But they want a level playing field. They don't want to make sure that nobody games the system. And, you know, like every rule, the reason the rule exists is because someone somewhere in the past tried to game the system by doing 10.5 font instead of 11 font or 12 font, you know, just trying to squeeze a few more words in there. So there's a reason why they do it. And you got to know in the industry that you can and you probably will be kicked out of the competition if you fail to follow the Section L guidelines exactly as they're written. So contractors agonize over every word because they know this. And they know that if it says 12-point font in the text and 8-point font in any graphics, they're going to follow that exactly because it could mean that you're not in the competition anymore.
And this is a really big deal to spend some extra time talking about. The example would be, why are you being so specific about 12-point font and it has to be Times New Roman? That's just, you know, this is that whole argument of government's so detail-oriented and they're going to kick us out and they're being nitpicky. Well, think about that. If you put in a 12-point font, 20-page proposal, and somebody else put in an 11-point font, 20-page proposal, they're getting, well, what, 9% more space. So they can write more content. They can put an extra graphic in there. They can use another story of how awesome they are. I mean, this sounds really, when you zoom out and go, oh, yeah, they're just being mean. But you think about what actually happens. So it was a big deal, and that's why you'll see in Section L, and okay, maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit here to Section M, when they say they have so many pages. If it says 20 pages and you submit 22 pages, they're only going to review 20 pages because I'm being kind of condescending on this one. But if you can't make your case in 20 pages and somebody else can, look, I'm not real confident you can manage a $5 million contract if you can't cover a basic instruction. Yeah. So that's the cynical way of looking at it. But really, it's around the idea of back to the level playing field. If we give you graphics, or say we can do, you do 8-point font and graphics, and you give me a full page of graphics that's 8-point font, but it's all text. It's like, well, that's not a graphic.
You're right. Just trying to. So a lot of RFPs actually say any attempt to circumvent this will be reflect upon you poorly or whatever, and that's what you're talking about with pretending that a graphic that what is text is really a graphic. So another thing, Kevin, this is a really important difference between commercial industry proposals between companies and business to government type of things. Commercial, no one's telling you exactly how to put together your proposal and how many pages it has to be, because the playing field doesn't have to be level in the commercial world, right? The better you are at selling your product, the more you're probably going to sell. And so if you submit a 5,000-page proposal or a 5-page proposal, it depends on what the customer's more interested in. Do they want the detail or do they want not as much detail? You might actually be able to sell better with a smaller proposal than with more detail, but it's totally up to you. But when you're dealing with the government, everybody has to do exactly the same thing the same way, and that's just to level the playing field. Government's all about being fair.
And so here's I love using stories because it helps people understand. So hopefully by the time this comes out, you're going to see that my company's website has been revamped. I'm really excited about it. We're so close. Anyway, the process of hiring the company to do the website was really, we had basic requirements. We didn't know. As you can imagine, we had an RFI process where we asked, what kind of stuff is out there? What's the art of the possible? Put together a budget, et cetera. But point of this exercise is we said, okay, give us a proposal of what it would take for you to do all the stuff that we want to do, make it do all these capabilities, et cetera. One proposal was like 25 pages, but had all manner of stuff that, just a lot of boilerplate, blah, blah, I would kind of treat it. A couple of them were 5 or 6 pages. One of them was 3 pages. And essentially what he said was, this is your requirement. This is how we execute it. Here are the 10 bullets of the things that we're going to accomplish. And they all met our need. He didn't get into how, he didn't get into what, and I didn't tell them I need you to explain how. I didn't tell them you need to explain how you're going to recruit and retain top people. I didn't get into all that. I said, I want you to show me how you're going to deliver this product. So in the commercial world, I didn't give them a specific number of pages because I didn't really want one. Whereas in government, if you're buying a testing program for, a missile system, you have a specific requirement. You need a certain number of pages. You have seven or eight companies that can do this, that have the software, et cetera. They need to show you how are they going to do it, particularly if, for example, it's a cost-type contract. Now you really need to know how are they going to do it. So there's just so much more, so many more layers to this. And the only way those layers work is if everybody is basically swinging at the same baseball.
Yeah. Can you imagine if you sent out Section L kinds of instructions to vendors to work your website, if you said, I need a 5-page proposal and
12-point font, no
12-point
graphics.
You have to, your approach is more important than management. I mean, so anyway, that's Section M stuff, but I don't think any of them would follow your instructions. They'd send you the same thing that they send all their customers.
And one thing I will jump on the commercial side, sometimes there is a bit of an RFP process, like in construction. A lot of my friends that work in commercial businesses, there is an RFP process. And they joke about the fact that theirs is nowhere near as robust as ours. Ours being those of us in government contracts. Yeah. So there is a little bit of bleed back and forth. But in a nutshell, like you said, if you don't follow Section L, best case scenario, you get your hand slapped. Worst case scenario, you get sent packing. And you're not going to win that argument. This goes back to the 80-20 rule. This is the process. The process said, give me 20 pages, 12-point font. If you give me 25 pages and 10-point font, I can kick you out.
Yep.
Because you know what? The other 10 companies didn't screw it up.
All right, so last Section L thing. I know we don't want to talk about the how so much, but one of the ultimate sin in Section L is boilerplate. And this is a word that you hear a lot in the government. I don't know if it's used outside the government, but Section L is it's tedious. It's difficult to write. I don't think anybody ever writes one from scratch. So usually they take the last source selection Section L and tweak it to meet their needs. But my experience from both sides is that it's often not tweaked as much as it should be. And Section L, as a CO, you can lead yourself into misery if you don't specify exactly what you need to evaluate the proposals to buy whatever you're buying that time. If you just leave in there, if the cost instructions say we need tables for pricing in calendar year and government fiscal year and by contractor year and by every line item, if you're buying something simple and that was the instructions from something more complex, you're going to get proposals with all that detail that the contractors will spend hours, days working on that you have no use for, but now you kind of have to evaluate because you got it all. So it's very important that you actually read every line of Section L and understand what you need for your particular acquisition. It's you need to understand what you're going to do with everything that you're asking for. And you really need to think about asking for just the minimum you need to buy what you're going to buy. So boilerplate, it's a great starting point, but...
Be careful.
Yeah, perilous.
Very perilous. So yeah, it's funny. You and I talked about the idea that there's a separate podcast coming up about how to do these well. We're going to try and keep ourselves focused on what they are. So move on to Section M under the context of the purpose of today's podcast is what are they?
Good point.
So Section M is how are you going to be judged? This is the evaluation factors for award. So in other words, the specific language, and again, for those of you following along in the FAR, it's 15204-5C, which I'm pretty sure is the next paragraph. And what it says is what significant factors and sub-factors, all those little elements, will be considered for award, right? And their relative importance. And those two things are really, really important because they both say will, which means that they need to be in there. So let's put on the contracting officer hat. If you don't tell people that price is more important than past performance and technical, and then you get to the end and then you award a contract to somebody who's higher priced because you happen to like their past performance, well, then you could get a protest and you're probably going to lose it because you said price is the most important. So the people that give you a lower price should have won, right? You kind of lean toward LPTA, which stands for lowest price technically acceptable. So these are the kind of things that it's very easy to get. I don't know. It's very easy to avoid some of the specificity of it. But the more specific you can be about these basic concepts, what's going to be considered and what's the relative importance? Because of that, and here's switch over to the contractor side, that's how you're going to win. That's the part where you go, well, if my superpower is that I have lots of past performance, but I can't compete on price based on the four or five companies I know that can do this, it's just not worth my time. As opposed to, okay, we're going to be relatively competitive, and it says past performance is the most important thing, well, and we've been doing this the longest, it's the only thing we do, then it's worth going after. So that clarity comes from this section. Section M needs to explain what's the most important items, and factors and sub-factors means factor can be technical, and then a sub-factor is things like how are you going to hire people? How, you know, what's your retention rate on employees?
That's probably more management than technical.
Okay, sorry. So, let me back up then. So the factor would be management, and then the sub-factor is how what's your turnover rate of employees? What's your safety rate record? I mean, there's all kinds of things that they could use to show how do you manage your company? How do you manage this program? Whether it's a production process or it's a service contract, whatever.
Right. So if you're buying a car, a factor could be speed, a factor could be gas mileage, and there could be sub factors under those. You know, you could have performance and then you know, top speed, gas mileage, braking distance. All those could be sub factors under the factor. There's not really rules on how you have to chop things up, but as a CO, anything you ask for as a factor and a sub factor, you have to evaluate, because again, the FAR says it will be considered. So you want to ask for the minimum number of things you need to evaluate and decide who's going to win.
So, okay, think of it this way. You'll get the minimum number of things you need to make your decision.
There you go.
Because this is the stuff you're going to use to evaluate people. So, and minimum is an important thing here, because it's very easy to end up with 17 sub-factors and sub-sub-factors. I mean, it can get nuts. And this is one of those... There's a saying about design, that design isn't done when you've added everything. It's done when you've taken everything that's not needed away, which is really ironic that we tend to overload these podcasts with more information. So it's kind of hypocritical to say that. But that was one of the challenges I had, was we were putting together a service contract, and you want to put the factors would be the service delivery summary would be, you know, how often, like you have to have somebody on this position 95% of the time. You have to be able to fill positions within 4 hours. You have to have responsiveness within to customer needs within 6 hours. And you pick these numbers and you end up with like 15 different variables. And if you can zoom out and go, okay, do we really need all of these different ones? Or can we just say, in order to meet the requirement within 6 hours, you're going to have all the people. So why don't I just say that one? So try to peel away some of those, because what happens is if you put 15 of them in there, you got to evaluate 15 of them. And it takes longer on both sides. So go back, you know, it's the minimum effective number. And that's why this is not always easy. And quite honestly, that's why one of the skills of acquisition is creativity, is you're trying to create the nice solution, actually the perfect solution, which we all shoot for. But you're trying to create a great solution that's just enough factors and just enough evaluation and just enough pages, for that matter, of content, going back to section L, so that you can get this done. And this is why, going back to the, you know, what's important in here, use this during a draft RFP. So when you say, I need this in 10 pages, and you get three or four, you know, I'm putting on the contracting officer hat. The contracting officer says, I want this all in 10 pages, and you get three or four different companies who are planning to bid, and they're like, dude, I can't give you all this in 10 pages. Or I can give you like the 50,000 foot level of it in 10 pages. So you either need to take out some of that content that you want, or you need to increase the page limit. And you can decide. I mean, you can go either way with that. It's just those are the kind of things that going back to the why of this podcast, is to increase communication. Is that for a company to say, writing a 10-page proposal in 2 weeks is hard. It sounds simple, but it's actually pretty hard. Well, writing a 20-page proposal in 2 weeks is probably something most companies go, you know what, unless I shut down my whole team and that's all we do, we're not going after this. So that could literally impact the company's ability to compete effectively, and they may walk away. So you, contracting officer, may get less competition because, again, you and I see this from a different perspective. Yeah. Now that we're looking at it from, wow, cranking out a 20-page proposal in a month, that's a lot of work. I just had a text go off.
Nice. So the opposite is also true. If it takes 20 pages to really describe what you want to buy correctly and you only give the offers 10 pages, it's just as hard to write a proposal that's where you only have half as much space as you need to successfully tell them what they need to know to make the right decision. In my mind, it might be harder. It's like you said before, taking everything else out, taking the extraneous stuff out is part of almost the hardest part. So let's describe real quick. The RFP is going to tell you the relative importance of the factors and the sub-factors. Describe real quick how that reads in an RFP.
Okay, so for example, you're going to see things like price is actually one of the ones we see the most often is technical is significantly more important than past performance. Past performance is significantly more important than price. When combined, technical and past performance are significantly more important than price. You notice how I can say that from memory, because that's what most people want to start with. And here
sounds like boilerplate.
That's right. Yeah, well said. It's exactly right, because it's boiled into my head. So Let me unpack that for you. So what we said was technical is the most important. In fact, it's significantly more important. Now, we didn't say it's 50% more important. We didn't say it was 17.6% more important. We said it's significantly more. That is what's used during a trade-off source selection, because you're trading, you're being nebulous on purpose, because you don't want to get in this debate of like, oh, well, it's two, you get 2.1 points for this and 7.1 points for that. No, this is usually more of a, some of this is art, not science. So if you want the ability to trade off, you have to leave a bit of fuzziness in there.
Right. But the contractors, if you're on the industry side, you're making a science out of it. Because as soon as you see significantly more important than this one, contractors are starting to assign percentages to each of those. And which is, you know, exactly the opposite. It's not nebulous when you're a contractor writing a proposal, because if in your evaluation of what's significantly more important or slightly more important than anything else, if technical comes out to be 40% of the total in your reading of the RFP, 40% of the pages get assigned to technical. And, you know, if there's sub factors, it's laid out the same way, that this sub factor is more important than this one or slightly more important. And the amount of pages that a contractor writes directly corresponds to how it is stated in the RFP about what's more important than what.
And this is a great discussion. That 40% is going to be Acme may decide that 40% makes sense. Whereas, you know, Bob's House of Consulting Services may decide it's actually 42%.
Right.
but that's why this is art and science, is that the science is going to be unique to each company. So let me show you what this feels like. So if you know, if you're a Department of Homeland Security contract, RFP comes out, and you have worked, you're the incumbent. You've worked there before. You know the people. You know exactly the kind of work that they do. It's for, I don't know, say it's for security services. They really, you understand, you're company X. You really understand this customer. When they say past performance is significantly more important than, in your mind, because that's your strength, your mind, you said, okay, that's 50% of our talking time and out of this 40-page proposal. Whereas if you're a company who doesn't have any past performance with that particular agency, but you've worked with the Border Patrol, although ironically that might be part of Homeland Security, but anyway, you get my point. You've worked with different agencies. You weren't the incumbent on this contract. So you come up with, well, based on what we have, we're going to say it's 45% or 40% or whatever. So for the contracting officer to understand, when you put out that ratio of significantly more important than, or for example, if you say technical is more important than, hear the difference? You take the word significantly out of it, and all of a sudden it's 30% instead of 50. See, this is all happening in the background. And each company is going to treat that differently based on what their strength is. And here's the fun part. If you're not thinking about that, if you look at that and go, I don't know how to judge that because I don't know this customer. Here's one you shouldn't bid on. Because the people who have been watching this, have been working there, have been paying attention, you know, they're really aware of all these nuts and bolts, and they understand this process, they're going to beat you. Sorry. So right. Rather than, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, big picture, you get a look at, does the government want the lowest price thing that barely meets the requirements, where, you know, price and technical are approximately equal, or price is more important than technical? Or does the government want the best product that meets and maybe even exceeds some of their technical requirements, and they're willing to pay a little bit more if those exceedances are valuable to them? So this is where you start to figure this out. What are you laughing at? Exceedances?
Exceedances?
That's
that
a word?
Okay, it's a Paul word. That's pretty cool.
All right.
One more thing is that the sub-factors are also going to be, you're also going to understand the relative importance of the sub-factors. So here's an example of how that plays out. If you have the technical approach is how you're going to manage the contract overall. You're going to manage the technical nuance of the production piece. But then there could be some task orders or delivery orders if it's production. And so each one of the, you have a couple sample delivery orders where you give a couple of products, and that each one of those three are going to be relatively equal in importance. Maybe they're in descending order of importance. I mean, you got to read that and understand it. And from a contracting officer perspective, you need to explain it to them so they understand the order of importance of all of these different factors, because that's what they're spending their time on. They're going to work. And this is by the way, this is one of the things that I figured out after I moved to the industry side, is they're going to use every hour you give them. And they're going to spread those hours out based on this, based on what's more important. If you say that past performance is the least important thing, and you basically are saying, yes, we have to evaluate it because FAR Part 15 says we have to, but more realistically speaking, we don't really care. Or here's a fun one. There are circumstances, which we'll get into. I can give you the FAR reference. I think it's even in FAR Part 15, where past performance doesn't not actually have to be evaluated if the contracting officer says that it doesn't need to be. So, and that's a whole other story. But my point is, they may only make 1% of their effort just covering, yes, we've done this.
Right.
That decision's made on what's written in Section M. So they're reading every word of it and making huge sweeping decisions based on it. So,
yeah, and that's something that, especially as a junior contracting officer, you just don't have a lot of perspective into the what you can cause, what havoc you can cause on the contractor's side with your instructions.
Or what opportunity you can create. Let's be optimistic,
brilliant,
too.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Havoc.
Okay, that's it for part one of this episode. Stay tuned for part two, where we get deeper into why Section L and Section M are important to government and to industry. As always, if you have questions, comments, or complaints, send us an email at paul@contractingofficerpodcast.com or kevin@contractingofficerpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.